Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawhi and Scott Wigan, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Annie. We wanted to dig into all sorts of, I think, topics with you because you wear a lot of hats. You've been at Valley College for some time in a variety of different roles. So we can get into all of that, but we'd also like to hear about the path that led you to Valley College, you know, what your own educational pathway was like, stops along the way, and what ultimately brought you here when you first started. So we can start the story wherever you're most comfortable. We can start in the present and work our way back, or start in the past and work our way forward.
Okay, well, we can start in the past, the not-too-distant past. Let's see. I actually never heard of Los Angeles Valley College, although I did see it on the freeway sign when I went up and down, you know, the 101. I used to live in Playa del Rey area, and I have been, you know, teaching as an adjunct, being a freeway flyer for a couple of decades, and that's how I would see Valley College. But I didn't know what it was or where it was until 1994. And at that time, I was commuting from Playa del Rey to Encino. I had my own business. I did career advising for lawyers. I did continuing education for lawyers and paralegals. I taught everywhere I could to eke out a living, as you know how, you know, freeway flyers do, adjuncts. I've taught in probably most community colleges and private schools and universities in my career in teaching in the area of law and paralegal studies. And so I was at an Encino Chamber of Commerce breakfast meeting in October of 1994. And if you don't know how those things go, they're very large. It's a community organization, it's businesses, a lot of people, maybe 75, 80 people with round tables. And then at the very beginning of every meeting, they're what they call the pop-up. And the pop-ups is where you have a minute to introduce yourself. It's like a commercial. And so I'm sitting at my table and, you know, talking with my friends and this one, and a gentleman gets up and he says, "Hi, my name is Dennis Reed and I'm a dean over at Los Angeles Valley College." Well, that's all I needed to hear because, number one, I wanted to work at Valley College. I didn't know what it was or where it was, but I knew I needed a job. And the second one, I thought, well, maybe they need a paralegal program, not knowing anything about the college. But I was definitely sure they needed a paralegal program. So I had my eyes on that table across the room. I was just adamant about not letting that Mr. Dennis Reed leave that room until I got to talk to him. So after about an hour and a half, you know, the breakfast meeting and so forth, everyone gets up and then it's a networking kind of opportunity where I beelined directly to where he was, where there was like a number of people around him, parted the sea and said, "Hello," I had my card, of course, "I'm such and such, and do you have a paralegal program at Valley College?" And he said, "No, but I'm a dean over extension, and we were thinking about that, or a court reporting program." And I said, "Well, I'll put your mind at ease. You don't need a court reporting program. You absolutely need a paralegal program." And so I said, "I'll be in touch with you, and I'll send you a proposal." And when my proposal came a couple of days later, he was shocked because no one really ever follows through when they when they go to a meeting like that. It's all about shaking hands and kissing babies and, you know, networking and things.
Was this proposal something you had pre-canned, or is this something you worked over the weekend to get out to him?
I did it so quickly. It was all in my head. I mean, I had been doing paralegal programs before at UCLA and teaching law and at Santa Monica College, so it wasn't all too difficult to do, but it's pretty much I wanted to do it, and I get very motivated when I need a job. So that's what happened. And I met with him and he said, "Okay, well, you know, we have to." And that was October of 1994. And every month I was renting an office space in Encino. I was doing my thing, you know, and this and that. And I had his business card at my desk. And every month on the dot, I called the office. I spoke with his assistant, his secretary, Eileen, and I said, "Hi, I'm calling to see how we're progressing on the paralegal program," every single month. And it was the same thing. "Oh, thank you for calling, but, you know, we're still this, still that." You know how colleges work. They're slow. It was so funny after the fact, you know, years later, that they expected me. Oh, they called me that girl That girl's on the phone. That girl's on the phone again. And so 8 months out, every single month for 8 months. And then in April of 1995, I was working and teaching, and I was the career coordinator for a private paralegal / court reporting school in Van Nuys called Merit College. And on, I think it was April 5th, coming to its, you know, its anniversary in 1995, April 5th, it was a Friday, at about noon, I get to campus and I see padlocks on the door. I see signs that said this program is no longer in existence. I see people outside crying because it was unfortunately the same day that they were graduating people. And I saw employees taking things out, like clocks and books and chairs and desks. And I'm thinking, what the heck is I'm feeling a vibe here. I know something is wrong. And so I get inside and I ask the administrator, what's with the padlocks and the people pilfering? I mean, I don't understand. We have class tonight. Well, it was the time where, and thankfully that changed over the years, but private schools, predatory schools, taking advantage, buying in and out, pirating for financial aid gain on the administrators, the owner's part, and just abandoning schools. And that was what was happening. And we had 600 court reporting, 600 people. We're about 100 employees, 600 court reporting students, and about 150 paralegal students at different phases. And I thought it was so egregious, and they just dumped everybody, and it was a horrific scene. The police were called. People were crying. A law firm, Eve, across the street set up a table on the sidewalk taking names. It was incredible. And so guess who I called when I got back to my office that day on a Friday? I called Mr. Dennis Reed, and I said, listen. Well, it was the next day. So this must have been a Thursday. So Friday morning, it was in the paper, that it was in a local Valley paper. And I said, this is the opportunity that we've been waiting for. I can get in. I can organize a program to save. We had 28 students who I thought we would be able to save. It had just started a term. There were four terms in that, how they worked it out. But I said, we have 28 people I've identified who are halfway through. We can finish them. I can develop a program. We can make a payment plan. We can save these people. And it would be great. You know, you're the knight in shining armor, Valley College, and we can do this. I have the connections. I have the files. And so he said that morning he had talked to our former president, Tyree Weider, who came to him and said, what are we going to do? Saw the notice in the paper. She said to him, what are we going to do about this? This is terrible. It was happening over and over again. And Dennis said, I think I know who's going to call me in a little while. And I did. And that was our first program, and we started, and I was like a telemarketer. We got 26 out of 28 people. We did a program for them that they would continue. It was August of 1995 where we had we saved 26 people. Two of the individuals didn't want to come with us. They wanted to go with another private school at the time called Catherine College, which did the same thing to them months later. So they lost the opportunity. And then that fall in 1995 was when I wrote the first professional paralegal program under the extension program. Still working, not on campus, but out of an office. I was an unclassified person. So that's how I started at Valley College.
Wow. Yeah,
I know, some story. Yeah. And then I developed the legal secretary program, developed the human resource assistant program, and some other things along the way. And that's how I started. And of course, teaching in my own program in that. So that's how I started. And it was pretty something. So Mr. Dennis Reed saved a lot of students, this college did, and also gave me a job. Yeah.
Well, I think I want to emphasize, too, is that one of the reasons why you want to go to community college and not these for-profit schools is that you don't know what will happen with these for-profit schools. Even the big names like ITT, who just, you know, closed down one day and sort of ripped off all their investors, now being sued by their investors and by their students. The Corinthian colleges, the Brymans, they were all closed down by the Obama administration for just being fraudulent. And part of the problem is that all these nonprofit schools, they accredit each other. So if you are a school that has this habit of closing all the time and then just taking the profits with you without giving students their degrees, happens in nursing, happens with a lot of different, so these two-year programs.
Absolutely.
And one of the things that sort of protects you in terms of community colleges is that we protect each other, right? I mean, that we audit each other. is that if a neighboring community college is doing something illegal, we spell it out because we are basically a, you know, no one's making profit off of this. Right. There's a public trust there that we're watching each other.
And in our open houses, I mean, I instituted the open house, and we'd have open houses and we advertise. And in every open house that we did, one of our mottos was, we can't close. We are a state agency. We cannot close. If something happens, and it has along the way, it's very unusual. Let's say Compton College, for instance, it's taken over by another district. We cannot close. We cannot close the doors on you. We are public. We have open access. And it's not to say that all private schools are bad. I mean, most of my education has been in private universities. I am a community college product. I graduated from the West Los Angeles College. So I went to a community college in our Los Angeles Community College District. But when you're talking about careers and trades, a lot of people think it's easier to get in. It's not as large. It's not as scary. Don't fall for it, really. Community colleges, we have marvelous programs. We have career tech education. We have, of course, our paralegal program is still in existence and thriving. And I stopped doing that in 2008 when I transferred over to the student services area, where I was given a whole new job description of being the college disciplinarian.
Okay, I have to pause you here because I want to dig into that aspect of your job. But you'd mentioned that you graduated from West. You went to private universities. Can you share a little bit about your educational background and even prior to 94, as you sort of started this story, you know, as a freeway flyer, as an adjunct, you know, working in all these different capacities? What sort of educational background and professional background did you have prior that allowed you to bring this proposal to Dennis Reed?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. And my parents never went to college. In fact, only my mother graduated high. My father never went past the ninth grade. So it was my grandmother who encouraged me to go to college. But of course, when you're young and you're a teenager, I don't need college. All I need to do is work, and I can work here and I can work there. And actually, my first, I was working in retail, and I thought that was what I wanted. And I didn't need college. Why do I need college? I can just work my way up and this and that. I didn't really have any role models. It was strangers who gave me, well, you really need to go to college. And it was where I kept hitting a boundary and hitting the wall, where I would see people coming in with a bachelor's degree, and I remember asking, what the heck is a bachelor's degree? I've never heard of such a thing. Why can't I be a manager? You know, I have all this experience in retail. Of course, I started retail by lying about my age because I wanted to be in it. In those days, they never checked. So, and a manager said, a bachelor's, you have to go to college. Oh, well, how do I do that? All right. So that's when I started West LA College. And then I wanted to, then I started working in a law firm. And I was inspired by the people I worked. I was a secretary. I had very good secretarial skills. And I asked the lawyers, I said, so what's this law school business? How do I do that? Because I see people, I was working in Beverly Hills. I saw people walking in nice clothes and nice cars. And it's like, I don't think I'm going to get there working as a secretary here, you know, servicing a law library. Well, you have to go to law school.
Did you come out of West with a degree or certificate training?
Apparently, I have a degree in art.
Okay.
I was just taking classes. Never, ever went to a counselor. Okay. No one ever. Students today have such opportunities because we tell them how to do things. And back in the day, it's just like you kind of did things. Not that there weren't counselors, but there wasn't an emphasis on making sure you knew what a counselor did.
Right.
So I just picked up a schedule, say, oh, that looks good. That looks good. And apparently I eked out at art and I said, oh, maybe I have enough credits. And I just sent to in the graduate department, decided I had a degree in art.
Okay.
I found that out when I got a copy of my degree. Oh, I have an associate's in art. Well, that's interesting. Okay. So someone evaluated what I did, and don't look at my transcripts at West because they have nothing. They are not like my other transcript. So I'm very similar to a lot of our students. And then I went directly with my 2-year degree, I went into law school because I didn't want to waste time getting this bachelor's degree. And I got a bachelor's of law and a law degree at the same time. So I did it concurrently.
Now, were you continuing to work at the law firm or did you stop going?
Oh, no, I stopped. I actually started working at the law school because in the paralegal department, that's when I learned about paralegal. Because I got a scholarship to go to law school for free if I work in the paralegal office.
And which law school did you go to?
University of West Los Angeles School of Law. It's a private school. See, a lot of my education is private. And then I worked in the field, and I was doing legal education and teaching law, you know, freeway flying. And then I decided I wanted to get into administration. I was working at Valley College, and I was hitting another barrier. I was hitting that wall again because, you know, a JD, of course, is a doctorate, but I didn't have a master's degree. And even though you have equivalency, who am I kidding? You have to be marketable. I needed a master's degree. So I'm here again in the same spot, have to go back to school. So then I'm thinking, well, what kind of master's degree? Business? Oh, I think I can't do accounting. I can't do, you know, John, you know, I don't do math well. And so... So I thought that's out. And when you're looking at higher degrees, you don't have as many choices as when you have undergraduate degrees. So I thought, well, psychology, that is the most relatable academic discipline. I can teach in it. It covers exactly what I do, being in this strange job that I have and dealing with, you know, all kinds of student complaints and working with faculty and working with students and the outside, because I did community relations as well. I think psychology is a great, great master's degree. So I went to Pepperdine and I graduated with a 4.0 because by that time I knew how to study. And then, of course, in law school, I was on dean's list. So, you know, you learn. And so that's my educational background. And it gave me that added marketability to having the master's degree. And I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. And it really coincided. I got that before I was given the opportunity to be the disciplinarian, but it is a very, to have law and psychology, I think is a very unique and appropriate background.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely complimentary. Now, when you were going through Pepperdine working on the master's in psychology, you were working at Valley College still?
I was full-time.
Okay. So full-time employee and full-time student taking classes nights, weekends, or what was that like?
Oh, it was pretty rigorous. I, like most students, saved the really hard stuff till last. So that last summer, I did it in 2 years straight, and I really have to give kudos to my supervisors at the time who worked with me. Their evening program started at 4:30. I don't know in what world 4:30 is evening, but it is in academia, in master's, in Pepperdine at 4:30, like a nighttime. So I had to make adjustments, work overtime. I mean, extra hours. I didn't get overtime. So I had to make up the time, do summer classes. Ooh, it was studying in the library. It was rough.
Were you driving to Malibu or were you doing
driving to Culver City. That was where it was. Culver City and Encino were my two camps. Malibu was actually more expensive if I wanted to go there. I thought, no. So I was driving all over the place. And that was pretty rough, but I loved the program. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate goal was to complete. And so even if, and this is a word to students and what we all tell students day at a time, sometimes moment to moment, keep your eye on the future and what your goal is. And faculty will work with you. You know, your support group is very important. If you work, your supervisors are very important to help you along the way and communicate what you want to do. If people don't know what it is that you want, my experience is people are always willing to help. They always will give you a helping hand, but you got to tell them, you got to let them know to get you through it.
So you feel how do each one of these three degrees then help you with what you do now with this?
Well, I guess I've always been very artistic. My background before that was in theater. And if we want to go way back, I was like 4 years old. I remember wanting to be an actress, and I think I am. I don't think that has varied. I think in the work that I do, you have to be extremely persuasive. And my superpower is that, I think, is being very persuasive. I mean, my husband continues to question himself, why do I believe you every time you tell me to turn right when I know it's left? It's because you're so darn persuasive about it. You're emphatic. Well, this is how it is. And so that persuasive ability, that talent, I think is also very complimentary. So before that, I was interested in the arts. Clearly, I have that art degree. And creativity. And I think the creativity, being resourceful and how to navigate in a very structured, bureaucratic way, I think is a challenge. It's what makes it fun. It's what makes it more collaborative to how to work around what we have is a structure, which I appreciate, but we still need to get things done. And so that creativity plays a big role in that. And then you have the law, which is a perfect blend for me because I think it's very creative. I think, and I tell my students, I teach at Valley College and I've been teaching constitutional law and civil rights. Now every fall, I'm going to an online, I go back and forth between online and in class. Now it's going to be an online course in the fall. And I think I tell my students, you would never know what position I really feel about when we talk about issues and cases, because one has to recognize both sides and be an advocate for either side. And I think that is also a distinguishing feature that my legal education has brought me, is to be fact finder, is to have that critical thinking and to recognize both sides of the coin. Even though I might have an opinion on one, I can argue any side as well as the one I really believe in.
So we should probably go into detail. Like, what is your role here now?
Depending on the day. And the call that comes in.
And we stopped at 2008, you said. Is that when
that's the
transition?
Yes, that's the day that, I had been campaigning to get into student services for 3 years. And there was a little transition going on in student services. So at the time, I reached out to our VP of student services at the time. And I said, it's hard to change divisions. I said, I think this is a good opportunity. She goes, this is God sent, because I didn't know what to do. There was some transition. Okay, let's make it happen. And so it was just sort of, again, my proactive nature, if you want to call it that, perseverance.
Well, I think there is a real value to knowing what you want and just asking for it. Make it personal.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
I think, it's too much of a lot of my students. Sometimes when we're talking about how to promote yourself, they're waiting for people to read their mind. And the people I see who are successful is they figure out what they want, they start doing the job, and then they ask for the job.
I've always created my own niche in the job. I see something. I mean, there's the job, but then I always go out of my way and above and beyond to see what can I bring more to the job, about the job. I'm not complacent in any role. I know that every role is tentative, and I want to make it, best for, the greater good. And so when that happened, I was ecstatic. And I had a whole laundry list of other job, other job duties at the time, managing grants and some other. I did the ACE program, which is our college, high school to college pathway. I managed that for a couple years. But it was the discipline that I really took to another level. Actually under our board rules, vice president of student services is given that responsibility of all student discipline. Every vice president in this district of student services has delegated that to a dean, because it's hard, and a vice president's job is so involved at such a different global level. I mean, this is a full-time position even of itself, the discipline. And so our college really dedicates all of its resources to me doing that with the ombuds, which came in 2012, actually. And so it's been growing and growing. And so I've made it into a program, more or less an intervention. And I think that's where the psychology background comes in, and the legal background comes in as well. Because it's not just about dispensing discipline. Anybody can do that. Anybody can say, okay, we're going to suspend you for X amount of days, or we're going to put an immediate on you, or we're going to expel you, or we're going to slap your wrist. Next. I don't do the next. I want to know why. We can always do the discipline. I talk to however many people there are. I reach out to, I do background information, whatever I can get on that student. I reach out to the other instructors. How is this student progressing? Is it something that's extrinsic? What's going on in that person's, And I get information from the faculty. Yeah, they've been having a really hard time. Students confide in faculty. And I use that to our mutual advantage. I want to know the whole picture, because discipline is a point. If someone is acting out or in any way, whether it's behavioral or through academic dishonesty or whatever, there's a reason. And I want to know what that reason is, so we can help that person succeed and it doesn't keep happening, because it is a disruption in their career. And we don't want to be that college that stops their education. It's tenuous at best. It takes so much for students to even get here, nevertheless stay here, right? Isn't that all about retention? And so we look at, so I developed this program over time of real intervention and real kind of holistic looking at, because the rules are the rules, discipline's discipline. We have a process, but inside of that process, there is discretion as to what we consider, and that needs to be the whole person. And so that's the program that I've created along with faculty from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, whenever I worked with you, I've always felt you very fair.
Thank you. Very fair
in terms of your discipline, and then very thorough in terms of just understanding who that person is and why whatever is happening is happening. And then I see you being very proactive, is that if we can help this person, let's help this person.
Yeah.
So I always send my students to you, like the ones that do bad things, I send them to you with all confidence that what's going to happen to them will be fair. And then they'll come back to me and say, don't worry, it'll be fair, but you have to face it, go.
And you know, it's a learning experience. In my experience, even when I work with students who complain about faculty, because that comes every day too. Oh, it's not fair. I don't think it's fair. This is not fair. Nothing's fair. Nothing is fair when you don't like it. This grade, you know, bad grades hurt your feeling, right? And faculty take it very personally when you cheat on them. It's very interesting how that works, and everyone seems to personalize things, and that's understandable. But at the end of the day, you still can't cheat, you still can't misbehave, and you still have to face it. And it is a learning experience. And every single time in the last, I've been doing this now 10 or so years, there is always more than one positive outcome. Either it's a syllabus gets revised to make it more, to make it clearer for that student, to articulate the rules more for that faculty. We have a lot of adjuncts who maybe have a one-size-fits-all syllabus. They teach in a university, which is far different than a community college. And even our colleges, like in different districts, differ greatly. And so one size doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. And there's always a positive outcome, positive learning experience. I mean, it's kind of funny, but a lot of times I get thank you notes, I get thank you cards, I get, you know, people follow up with me. If it wasn't for you and that bump along the road and that real intervention, I would not have been able to succeed in my other classes. It really taught me I can't fool around anymore. Mm-hmm. I have students who have come back to me saying, because you suspended me, I am now a better person. And I have people that are in law school now because mm-hmm. of something that happened 8 years ago.
So I know talking to a lot of professors are afraid to send someone to document cheating. I document everyone. Right, and I send them to
you. Yes, you do. And I appreciate that.
I document the hell. You cheated my class. We're going to write you up. We're going to make it official. But maybe you can allay some of the fears in terms of what that means once I write my documentation and it goes to you. What do you then do with the documentation?
Well, we are of the motto, see something, say something, and that goes for everything. And it's, in my experience, it's all awkward, isn't it? I mean, faculty aren't there to report students, and students are not there to report other students. But there is a ethical and a humanistic component to this. We want to recognize a student's problem. Now, I think that 90% of all faculty don't report, and they handle whatever they handle in the classroom. And while that's great, and I admire that, and I think it's fine, I mean, you should, classroom management. However, if it becomes repetitive, then clearly there is another kind of a problem going on. Even if it's not repetitive, and in your discretion, you believe that my intervention is going to be worthwhile, then I welcome it.
Yeah. Well, the thing I don't want is for every student to cheat until the first time they get caught in that class and then wait for the next class.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So student A is in your class, John, and student A is in your class, Scott, and and somebody else's. And whatever the problem is, no one's reporting it. And semester after semester after semester goes on. And then I don't hear about it. And it's the first time to me, but it's not the first time at all.
Right.
And that doesn't help anyone. It really doesn't help the student. It doesn't help our faculty.
So I think the fear that some faculty have is that it goes on some permanent record. That's not true, is it?
Well, actually it is. So, well, here's how that works. So we have something called informal and then formal. And when you're talking about discipline is part of an educational record. And under the law, it is permanent, but it is not the same kind of academic permanency like a grade. And so on a transcript, if you will have grades, you will have A through F, you will have W's, you will have I's for incomplete. That is a transcript. A discipline record is not on a transcript, but is nevertheless part of one's academic record and discoverable. A suspension under our administrative regulation is permanent. a suspension over 10 days. I will qualify that. A suspension that is fewer than 10 days is also permanent. Anytime you have the suspension, it is part of an academic record for that student's life. However, it will not appear on a transcript, and it's basically an honor system. You know, that common application where it says, or if you join the military, if you join any government, it says, have you ever been disciplined, student disciplined? The onus is on that applicant to say, yes, I have. It's been my experience that they're very understanding along the way. It's one time, one discipline. Probably everyone has a bump along the way. An expulsion, you might have to explain that a little bit to that university down the line or that employer. But it is permanent. Now, anything like a written reprimand or which is don't do this, but it's in writing or a warning, disciplinary probation, these types of actions can be expunged after 7 years, but they are academic records. So it is important, and I'm glad you bring that up, because having said that, that's why I take this very seriously. I do not want to dispense discipline just for the sake of it, because it is permanent in a way. And so I use that as a motivator and negative reinforcer, if you will, to prevent something from happening.
So what agencies commonly request discipline records?
Well, any kind of law enforcement will ask for that. It's an honor system, military will. And if you lie as an applicant, that is cause for dismissal because you're lying on an application as far as the university goes. And it's always best to tell the truth. It's always best not to get in trouble. But I mean, if you can, if you could prevent that, then it's always best to be very honest about it. And in my experience, when students, I explain this, no one's perfect, and everyone has bumps along the way. And based on circumstances, and they're always based on circumstances, people go through rough patches with families and interruptions of that, with economics, all kinds of deficits. We talk about homelessness, food, what is it called?
Food insecurity.
Food insecurity. All of these things play a role in our students' lives. And I think that oftentimes trickles into the classroom. And that's why if I have a message to all students, if you're ever experiencing any kind of difficulty, whether it be in a family situation, in a living situation, do tell someone. If it's not our psychological services, tell your faculty. We train faculty all the time to refer. It's in the syllabus. We really, really care about students. Say to your counselor, let somebody know so we can, we have lots of services here on campus to retain students and to help them. And I'm one of those referrals.
And I kind of echo the sentiment that you mentioned earlier, John, in how much I appreciate and value that you always approach all of this, Annie, through that lens of really trying to help the students. It really is a very, I think, student-centered, approach that you take under this umbrella of discipline. I'm curious, so you mentioned cheating is something that comes up. What are some of the other, you know, common reasons why students will be referred or end up in your office? What do you see?
What's always prefaced by, well, you know, I have this student. I know that when I get a phone call, hi, this is Annie. Hi, this is Professor such and such. Well, I have this student. Yes, clearly. That's what you're calling me. So, I think I'm going to write a book. Oh, I have this student. I think that's going to be opening line. It varies. I think that's very interesting. By the time I get the phone call, whatever the situation is, it's been happening. And it goes for online as well. Don't think that students can't misbehave online. They do. It's called all caps. And it's screaming and yelling, and it's talking about
just
very strange
typing.
Thing. Rude typing. Oh, yeah, we've had to discipline caps. So it's just another modality. But some of the interesting cases, and when I talk to students, I'm very direct. As you can tell, I don't beat around the bush. Avoidance is not one of my problems. it is direct, but as nice as possible. Some of the situations can be your basic cheating, right? And then last summer, we had a very interesting, I call it the sting of 2018, which was in the summer. and it was out of the math class, math department, if you remember, mm-hmm. where a group of students during the summer, I'm talking about a group, not two or three, more like 30, were really sort of, their actions were not, let's say, on the up and up, and a number of them were caught by the professor in cheating in real time with an app on their phone. And it was caught, and so we suspected that this was really kind of going on. These were transfer students from another university. And so we did a little background on that, and working with the faculty and with some other, I don't have anyone working with me in terms of assistance. It's just me. I'm a lone ranger. But I do have other resources in admissions and records, financial aid. So we pulled together, and we had a big sting in 2018 where we caught a number of students, and we prevented a lot of cheating. So that was fun. So that was huge. That was epic.
Yeah. I'll have to ask around. Yeah. I didn't hear about this. They've been pretty.
It was kind of
quiet. Chair's been pretty good about keeping it quiet.
Yeah, these things can be confidential. The great sting. I had proctors. It was a thing. It was very exciting.
Have you seen?
I mean, that's the kind of thing that's exciting for me.
Yeah, right. Definitely sounds like some drama.
Let me tell you, when I catch someone cheating, I'm happy. Yeah, I'm giddy. I hate cheating. Cannot stand cheating. So you know. They always, like, you'll come back 2 hours later, you'll cry in front of me. I'm still writing that note. It's still official, you know. And just so you know, when you walk out, I'm still happy.
I don't have Kleenex because you can cry all you want, but that just doesn't affect me.
Yeah.
I'm not a counselor.
Have you seen an increase in cheating over the last 10 years and, you know, people using technology in a different way, apps and such? Or
well,
is it the same and just sort of different ways of cheating as far as
I
the
think
number
there's
of
some. I brought a sample if we were some kind of video. I brought a sample of a pencil that I was showing my colleagues here, and this was confiscated by a very, let's say, instructor who was doing a very good job of proctoring. But I mean, it's an old-fashioned, old-school way of cheating where I have a number two pencil that I'm looking at right now with tiny little crip marks run in pencil. I can't even with my glasses see what's on this pencil. And if you think, students, that faculty member who's proctoring a test isn't going to think that someone reading their pen is a little suspicious, I think you're not living in the real world. It's very suspicious if you have your pencil and you're reading it instead of using it. It's also very suspicious if you keep opening up your pencil pouch and keep looking at notes that people have confiscated. It's also very suspicious keep looking at your phone, which of course you shouldn't have on your desk. But so all of these kinds of suspicious activities are old school new modalities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Notes, note taking. So now there's apps. So now there's texting. You know, students who are getting texts, they hide their phones. No, stop doing that. We it's old school, just new methods. It's cheating is cheating.
It's right. The iWatch that gets me.
I've got
the watch. Yeah.
You know, I have to take all my students take their iWatch off.
Yeah, but don't like collect them because.
I don't touch any technology. I mean, we had this conversation before. If I had a teacher who would collected phones, I would just give him a broken phone.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And then when he busts,
then I'm getting another kind of call. I'm getting a union call, and we don't want that.
Yeah, so it's that iPhone because, you know, I'm old. I can't see. And that's what gets me. So I'm at the point now where I just no walk.
Well, you know, you have to keep up with technology. And I don't know how people do it. But and then, of course, we've caught slews of impersonators. That's why in the math department, sometimes we ask for ID, and that's perfectly legit. And so that was one of the problems with the great sting of 2018 was impersonating others, because in a large class, you don't really know who your students are because it's short term, right? And you're getting through it day by day, and there's 40 people in a class or 30 people, and it's really hard to keep track because it's just very rigorous every day. And there's a lot of opportunity for impersonation. I've had tips. Tipsters are great. I love tipsters. So we have tipsters from the outside. Someone wrote me a couple years ago. I just saw this ad, I think you know about this, John,
right,
in Craigslist.
Yeah.
And it was a real ad in Craigslist that said, "Hi, with a real name, I'm such and such, and I'm looking for someone, I mean, I'm available to do something like take your math class at Valley College." And I thought, well, isn't that Interesting. So some tipster sent that to me. So I go undercover and I pretended to be a student from Valley College. And we ended up catching that person in the act.
You know what the best part of that was?
Remember, yeah?
Yeah. I will not pay more than $60.
Yeah.
I mean, gosh, imagine having to take a class for someone for 15 weeks for $50. That's not even minimum wage.
Wow, yeah.
No, I caught an impersonator. It was this group out of Boston. It was a whole group of grad students who were charging it was an online impersonation. It was another Craigslist thing, another tipster. And they said for $2,000, I was communicating with them. I pay through PayPal. It was all legit, I guess. And it was $1,800 for an online class. And so I asked the person, I mean, I created this whole character. That's where the theater background comes in. And so I was a bartender and I was really struggling. My name was Stephanie and I was really struggling with classes. And this was all email, of course, because it's all online, right? And I really saw this ad in Craigslist and my Stephanie and I have this really horrible boss and I'm really sure I want to get through school and just, you know, I have this U.S. history class and it's so hard. I just don't have the time. You know, I'm working full time as a bartender trying to get through school. And so I was doing all this and this very nice, helpful grad student in Boston told me, oh, no problem. I can guarantee you an A. I said, well, how can you guarantee me an A? Oh, well, we're grad students and this and that. And all, I said, well, what do I have to do? It's all, you know, it's online. It's all secure. Well, all you have to do is give me your ID and you can give me your password and I will impersonate you the whole time. Just all you have to do is send me the syllabus. And let me know. I said, you to impersonate me the entire whole time? And they said, oh, yes, absolutely. I said, well, how much is this service? Oh, $1,800. I said, well, that seems like a bargain. For $1,800, is that what you charge? Well, for a history. Now, a math class is going to cost more, of course, because it's more work and we have to get like a PhD kind of guy and, you know, and so all this. And so we did that. And of course, I never did that because the whole thing was a ruse. But I did turn that over to authorities. Because there may be financial aid fraud involved with that out-of-state stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like making fun of the other majors because the math bribery cases are always more. I think some kid had left $100 in the blue book for his teacher, and the teacher was
freaked out,
right? Uh-huh. And turned it into you. And I think someone else from history or psychology said, we had the same thing happen. It was only $50. And I said, you know, Mickey Mouse degrees cheaper, right?
I had music. So music goes for $400.
Does it really?
Yes, I had $400 for music. Wow. And they didn't want the money back. So we put it in the foundation for their account. They said,
want it back?
They did not want it back. I've had that for gift cards, too. I've had to send back. So, okay, so students... It's nice when you appreciate your faculty member, when your professor, a nice card would be good, but that doesn't mean a gift card. We can't accept gifts or alcohol or anything like that. I mean, people have given people like, you know, I don't know what happens that they don't report it to me, but you know, money's never good. You know, I love money in the blue book or the green book, whatever it's called. So those are some of the interesting cases. Right. But in answer to your question, it is not an increase in academic dishonesty. It was from 08 to fall of 2011. Tons of plagiarists, tons of cheating, tons of the pencil stuff and, you know, your regular soup to nuts cheating. But starting, and I don't know why, this was the demarcation. Fall of 2011 started the disruptor age. Where it was not just students constantly addicted to their phone, because that is a problem, but it was more of the threat assessment. I've got a student that just started screaming, yelling, very emotional. I think something's really wrong. They're scaring the other students. They're acting funny. You know, these kinds of psychological problems. And I also, in my work, have gone to other colleges, as a lot of people do at this institution, to do accreditation. You mentioned that before, Scott, where we, through our ACCJC, accredit, and we are peer evaluators. Mm. And so I've been on many teams in other districts across the state. And it is not uncommon. I mean, it is. It just got to us, sort of like in our district about 2011, 2012, and this influx of maybe it's, I don't know what it is. I don't think you can pinpoint why are we having an influx of more psychologically based disruptions or threat assessments or lockdowns or these kinds of incidents where it is immediate suspensions. I have had more immediate suspensions since 2015. I think an uptick of 450% if I'm looking, if I do, you know, we do our program review. Yeah. And these are just about what I know about, because I rely 100% on my faculty and staff to tell me what's happening. I haven't quite gotten that crystal ball thing in play yet. So I have to be communicated with if to do something.
Yeah.
If I don't know about it, I don't know about it.
I think it's the whole copycat thing. There was a big sort of rash right when that, at the time period you're talking about, I remember someone had called a bomb threat to Cal State LA and then had done the same thing at Berkeley. And that sort of seemed to start a rash all over through the entire country that people just started copycatting. It just became the new, you know how kids used to pull the fire alarm?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Except now this is serious, because now when you get caught for this, this is, you know, you're going to...
Well, that's one
really
thing.
Really bad things happen to you.
And then we have an influx of people who... for whatever reason, have food insufficiencies and have homelessness and have, we have returning veterans who have other psychological issues that we want to help with. And we have all kinds of these kinds of issues. And community colleges, I mean, let's face it, we are open access and we are second chances and third chances and first chances. And for some people, the last chance at an education. And re-entering, we have people who are formerly incarcerated. So we have special populations, foster youth, all kinds of, right? EOPNS, mm-hmm. first mm-hmm. generation. People who really are looking at community college as their way, their anchor. And we use that to assist us. College is an anchor. And so if that's important to someone, then they're going to try to rise above with a lot of help, whatever it is that's causing the problems. But we see this more than anything, and we are so, so fortunate to have a district that recognizes the value of having a contract with the Los Angeles County Mental Health, where we have in our district, I think it's been the last 4 or 5 years, we have teams. They go through other various names. It's called the HEAT team, their threat assessment team, where a psychological or a psychiatric social worker and a specially trained deputy sheriff is paired as a team. And they go out, like our team, they go to Mission College and Pierce College and Valley College is where they're housed here. And if it were, I mean, we certainly did our job before this contract that we had with LA County Mental Health. But I can tell you that with that contract and their help and our collaboration, I check in with them every day, more than once a day. They can do things that I can't do. They can go into the file. They can go do house calls. They can work with parents, things that I am restricted because of privacy can do. Right. It has been a godsend.
And I think we have to clarify that Valley College is like any other college, whether you go to UCLA, USC, every college I've been to has had security issues because we're just a large campus.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to other campuses that I've worked on, I've never been at a campus that has been so focused on making sure that people are safe than at Valley College, mm-hmm. right? When the sheriff is practicing, they're practicing on our campus. In terms of training, I've never been to a campus that's had as much training as we do. So before we scare people from not coming to community college or here, just understand that we're on it in terms of this campus, that we're pretty good at really working with the staff on this,
right.
more than any other campus I've been on.
We're not a high school with gates and the locked guards and the metal detectors. We're open access. And we want to stay open access. But having said that, I mean, we all have to be see something, say something. We didn't create anything that's wrong. We try to help. And so you're right. And we can always do more. We have a behavioral intervention team. We are the model college. And I'm glad you said that, John, because we have been recognized by our captain of the Community College Bureau as being the model college for behavioral intervention team. I'm working with him and with other district people in making our college the model, because it is the model. We are the Valley College. And it's not to say that other colleges don't do a good job, but we have a particularly, proactive, if you will, program where we work day in and day out with our team, with our faculty. And I think it comes from my vision and with the help of my faculty and staff of being that intervention and not just in out, right? We look at the whole picture of things. And so there's always improvements to be made. I don't think we do enough training, to be honest with you. We may do a lot of training, but it isn't enough training. Mm-hmm. We need to do training that is required training. Right now, it's all voluntary. And so we can have another conversation about that in the future.
I think, and that might be a good place here for us to set up our next conversation, because I feel like we probably just kind of scratched the surface and getting to know a little bit more about you, your background, what brought you here. Right. But in terms of the various trainings that you do put on for faculty, for students, for staff, what that looks like, how to sort of communicate that to the rest of the college, I feel as though we'll have many more conversations to come, Dr. Reed. With that, I want to just take a moment to thank you for the incredible work that you do at the college. In my position, I've had many meetings with you. we talk often on the phone, and
some semesters more than not.
That's true. And as I mentioned before, it's always within the context of rallying around the students and the faculty and figuring out how best we can support everybody. So thank you for your tireless effort on that and being, you know, such a leader and so dedicated in the work. And want to thank you for sitting down with us today and giving us an opportunity to find out more about what you do and how you got here. Until we follow up with you and have another conversation, if people do want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to connect?
The best way is to call, and that is 818-947-2320. I don't usually meet students in my office because of the nature of what I do. I'm a one-person practitioner, so I make appointments, I do a lot of phone work, and I will meet with students, but it's usually by appointment basis. But I'm always available to meet with students. I'll come to you if you're on campus, wherever you are, I'll come to you as well. So there's other places to reach out. And I look forward to our next conversation, because I'm sure our audience wants to hear more stories about some interesting things that we've done.
Most definitely. And can you give the phone number one more time, please?
Sure. It's 818-947-2320.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Valley College Connection radio show and podcast with Professors Scott Weigand and John Kawhi. If you would like to be a guest, recommend a topic, or find out more information, please email kvcm@lavc.edu. That's kvcm@lavc.edu. This has been a production of 95.1 KVCM Monarch Radio, the voice of Valley College, and the Broadcasting Club. Thank you for listening.